I am lucky enough to have Erica Miners, co-author of a book I have been reading nonstop since I ordered it, called The Feminist and the Sex Offender, Confronting Sexual Harm, Ending State Violence. It is abolition feminism at its finest. And abolition feminism is defined in the book to signify a politics marrying struggles against interpersonal violence with those against the violence the state inflicts in addressing it, the ineffective, racist, and profoundly destructive prison industrial complex. This book definitely has hit home for me because I definitely, like I say, I work with the unhoused, and one thing we try to do is not involve police as much as possible, because more often than not, they make matters much worse than they need to be. And as we are in the era of uprisings to call for the defunding of police, the pushback you get is constantly, what about the bad people? When we talk about prison abolition, first thing people say is, what about the bad people? This book is literally dedicated to that argument. It starts with the case of Larry Nassar. And if you don't remember who Larry Nassar is, there is a Netflix documentary that is trending right now called Athlete A about the Larry Nassar case. Larry Nassar was the Olympic female gymnast doctor and trainer. And he was also the trainer at the Michigan State University, where he sexually assaulted, I believe it was over 150 women.
That sounds right. I mean, that's what we know of. So.
And it went back years, like 20 years, right?
And of course, he was supported by a university, a culture, a context that looked away, and also a context that made the women who had experienced the harm feel like they couldn't report, feel like no one would believe them, feel like, well, maybe I'm too sensitive, right? So that kind of culture really, really facilitated his behavior for, you know, years. And for many of us, you know, that's a familiar story of a story of harassment in work sites, in educational context and universities and colleges. So yeah, the story of Larry Nassar is at one level a grotesque and exceptional story, but it's also a really familiar story.
It's a hard watch. I watched the documentary. I followed the coverage. The one place where I could actually get coverage on the case was Democracy Now. I felt like they were the only people that were really... Maybe because he's not a household name, it felt like there was kind of a unified F this guy. Kind of like Harvey Weinstein as well, because he's not necessarily a household name to most people. You know, Bill Cosby, there's definitely people on different sides of the fence. Michael Jackson, there's people on different sides of the fence. But with Weinstein and Larry Nassar, it definitely was like, throw him under the jail and put away the key. And he got a pretty hard sentence from the judge. And no one really said anything about that sentence. No one said, oh, well, maybe she's being too rough. I mean, in mainstream media for the most part.
Yeah, it's a complicated moment because for many folks, in particular folks that have experienced gender and sexual violence, it kind of felt like, fuck, God, somebody's paying attention. Like, somebody cares. Like, the state, you know, the state sees my harm. And the judge made a proclamation, you know, at that trial, a very kind of condemnation of him as well. And I think that many, many audiences resonated with that. With that statement that she made.
You have a challenge I'd like to read. It's called the Me Too Challenge. And it was written by Kelly Hayes and Miriam Kaba. Am I saying the names right?
Yeah, valued comrades.
I want to read this because this really hit me. The Me Too Challenge. This moment challenges those committed to transforming our carceral system, including people like us, who are committed to justice for survivors of sexual assault, and who also believe that prisons are the wrong answer to violence and should be abolished. We decry the system and advocate for change that is long overdue. Yet when that system ensnares people we loathe, we may feel a sense of satisfaction. When we see defendants as symbols of what we most fear and that which we most greatly despise, we are confronted with a true test of our belief that no justice can be done under this system.
Yes, we wanted to use that quote because, one, those are two powerful organizers, and mm-hmm. those are amazing words, and we try through the project to lift up the words and analysis of groups and organizations that are really doing the work to both name that gender and sexual violence is, you know, is a pandemic, mm-hmm. to use the word of the day, but also trying to raise the visibility of groups and organizations that are naming the reality that prisons, policing, incarceration is not the pathway to end gender and sexual violence, right? We continue to lock up more people, disproportionately poor folks, poor men of color, around gender and sexual violence, but we haven't ended the epidemic of gender and sexual violence. So the book is, I mean, sort of is reminding us that that's an old story in the United States, that the state often has promised, you know, to address the harm that some women, particularly white women, experience, but hasn't really addressed that harm. Women and children experience the harm that women and children experience, but not only doesn't really address that harm, but actually creates another complicated and layered punitive system that does more harm, you know, in the end as well. So here we have, you know, gender and sexual violence, which is a problem, but we have the state coming along and saying how we're going to address gender and sexual violence is we're going to punish more people, we're going to build more prisons, we're going to put more cops on the street. But we know that that hasn't resulted in an end to gender and sexual violence, in particular for some of the more vulnerable members in our community, trans folks, sex workers, young people, right? Those communities in particular have never, ever been served by the state response. So I think that's one of the tensions that we're trying to negotiate in the project and lift up. And folks like Miriam and Kelly and the many other organizations that are in the book are just a reminder that the book project is really trying to lift up the amazing work that is on the go of communities and groups that are trying to build these responses to gender and sexual violence outside of a state now, response.
You got this book is relatively new.
Yes, came out in a pandemic. Perfect
and,
time.
And I don't think you guys had a chance to to really rebut this because it's. I don't know if you've been noticing in the news as Joe Biden is gaining more traction as the Democratic nominee for president. One thing that does come up on his very odious record is the 1994 crime bill. And a reason why he pushes back on that and says, well, hey, it's not a bad thing because you got the Violence Against Women Act. Even Nancy Pelosi, who I would love to see out of office, go Shahid Buttar, even said the same thing. She goes, hey, Violence Against Women Act. That's why we did it. And it kind of shuts people up when you say that, because just that terminology, violence against women, it sounds like you're protecting this vulnerable population of weak individuals. So you guys write a little bit about it. But again, I know you didn't get a chance to see all this that was going to get thrown out about the Violence Against Women Act in this election cycle. So can you speak on that? Just a little bit, the Violence Against Women Act.
Great. You know. Yeah, great observation. And I also just want to flag that the only reason that Biden and Pelosi and, you know, in the last election, which seems like a lifetime ago, the last federal election, the Clintons, right, had to have any kind of public reckoning for the enormous omnibus bill that was passed, you know, supported by the Democrats, that put, you know, more police on the streets than ever on the planet, and funded prison expansion and took away education and prison programs, and of course included the Violence Against Women Act. The only reason why those Democrats had to be accountable for that piece of that body of legislation is because of organizers, is because of young Black folks, because of the Black Lives Matter movement, because community-based organizations were calling them, you know, on the carpet for their complicity in pushing forward an agenda of what gets called mass incarceration. I prefer targeted criminalization as a language, because the language of mass incarceration sometimes implies it's kind of arbitrary who gets locked up, right? And it's not. You know, we know that it's disproportionately poor folks, disproportionately people of color. We know that there's a connection between who gets punished in the United States and criminalized, and white supremacy and heteropatriarchy and capitalism, those 5-cent words, but I think really important. So I just want to, you know, acknowledge that the landscape shifted because of organizing. And your second question, which is a great question, around the Violence Against Women Act, you know, I think that my other comrade, Beth Ritchie, has a wonderful book that looks at specifically at how the Violence Against Women movement, how we might have, as she terms it, won the battle but lost the war, right? You know, so we got, she argues, with something, with legislation like the Violence Against Women Act, we might have gotten the state to pay some attention to particular kinds of violence against women. So violence against, you know, heterosexual white women, you know, the state might be paying some attention to, right, through legislation like the Violence Against Women Act. But we lost the war, she argues, in part because we lost the political and social movements that were actually interested in ending gender and sexual violence, right? So legislation like the Violence Against Women Act trains more cops to arrest arrest people in situations, puts more money into policing and sentencing and prosecution, but that doesn't actually end the problem of gender and sexual violence. And then when we see how that gets played out, how training cops to address domestic violence, for example, gets played out on the street, is that, you know, the cops will go and arrest sometimes the perpetrator and the person who's experienced harm because, you know, that's what they feel like.
They're trying to find the bad guy.
Trying to find the bad guy, yeah. So that was kind of a long response.
Hey, you got time. You wrote a book, so long response is what you do.
I wrote a book.
No, that actually just, the whole thing, and I don't think people really understand, when police come to a domestic violence situation, when people are calling to defund the police and they're saying things like, hey, we don't need cops to come to domestic violence situations, I think the average John Q. public thinks that it's a scene from a Lifetime movie. And a lot of times it's not.
Yeah.
As someone that breaks up domestic violence situations, probably on a daily basis. It's more complicated than people think, because you know, when we talk about violence against women, we don't really talk about equality. And if you're a woman that has to depend on a man for housing or for paying your bills, it's hard to call the police and see him get taken away. And there's all kinds of situations where we have like kids that need to come into a facility because the mom left the boyfriend who wasn't the kid's father, who's like, well, now you got to get out because you called the cops on me for whooping your behind. And I don't care where the kid goes, so the mom can get housing, but the kid can't. And it's way more complicated. Yeah. And police don't, they're not there to help solve that problem. Law and Order SVU, people listening, is a show. It's a show I watch. But I definitely understand that it's just as much fantasy as the never ending story. And that's again, that's why this book resonated with me so much, because these are things that literally I deal with on the daily, and you can't really explain this to the average person because they just don't get it. You guys really did a great job laying it out.
And also, oh, thanks. And it's really a pleasure to be here, you know, talking with you today too. I really appreciate the invite. I just also want to flag the enormous amounts of money that we're funneling into policing versus prevention or resources or free childcare or free healthcare, right? Thinking about all the, I mean, Chicago spends, I'm here in Chicago, about 40% of its city's operating budget on policing, right, every day, right? And those resources are then not available to support thinking particularly about these situations of domestic or interpersonal violence or intimate partner violence. We can use that language as well. And the examples that you offer that sometimes, you know, family and home life tensions and, you know, conditions are exacerbated by things like, you know, a minimum wage that's not a living wage, lack of free and accessible childcare, right? Lack of mental health services, right? For people who are experiencing crisis, right? Like, how much could we dissipate? I mean, I'm not being a Pollyanna here. Nobody would accuse me of that, right? But how much would we be able to prevent kind of context if we front-loaded some of those resources and provided the conditions, the money that we're spending on policing and punishment and arrest and sentencing and prosecution, if we could spend some of those resources on creating the flourishing conditions that we know that communities need, that frankly, whiter and wealthier communities often have access to, therapy, resources, you know, childcare, you know, somebody to come and make food for you, all that kind of stuff. So I just want to flag the defund and invest moment that we're in right now is a really important moment to be thinking, for all of us to be thinking about what makes our communities flourish. And I'm so happy that political movements in this moment that are really connected to long histories of people organizing, particularly the Black radical tradition, is really pointing to, you know, we got to invest, you know, in what makes our communities flourish.
Are you afraid, to that point, are you afraid that the movement can get co-opted by a much more milquetoast reform? So, for example, as people are yelling in the streets and destroying capital, like, we got to just abolish police, defund police, blah, blah, blah. And then you have, like, we're changing Aunt Jemima. We need to defund police. This is wrong. The carceral state is just destroying our community. You know what we're going to do? We're going to paint Black Lives Matter on the street and give you George Floyd Boulevard.
Yeah. I mean, yes, of course, right? I was just on a, you know, on a, you know, Chicago's trying to get the police out of the public schools, and we had a Board of Ed meeting, and before the agenda item on the Board of Ed about defunding the police, you know, there was a vote about, you know, introducing new military, you know, programs into our Department of Defense run Chicago has the most Department of Defense run public schools in the nation. And of course it was like Martin Luther King, you know, high school, you know, was going to be converted into a Department of Defense high school, you know. So, which isn't to say the military can't be an option for, well, the discussions about whether the military can be an option for people over 18 is a different story. But if we're saying that that's how young Black and brown folks can get an access to an education at 13 or 14, right, it's a, you know, it's completely unacceptable public policy decision. So yes, to your point, co-optation is always the history of social movements. The history is, you know, is one where recognition, you know, we're asking for redistribution of resources, of power, right, of fundamentally life pathways. We're asking for an end to premature death for communities. And what the state turns around often and does is feed our language back to us and gives us sort of tokenistic representation. I don't want to diminish representation. I felt a certain kind of glee when I saw the mayor of D.C. paint that right in front of what's-his-face's house right now, right in front of the White House. But I do think we want to keep our eye on the prize here, right? And know that the history of and become, you know, again, I sound like an old people professor, but, you know, really pay attention to the history of social movements and know that when we're being fed the swap, you know, the line, right? And I think keep our eye on our demands about radical redistribution and reorganization of power rather than just the easy representation. And I think this will happen. The Chicago Police Department, for example, has been astutely aware of the need to repackage itself, reframe itself. And this started decades. I mean, this is an ongoing initiative, but I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, now the Chicago Police Department says it does restorative justice work, right? Has an office of restorative justice. And as somebody who fought alongside community-based organizations, you know, when I moved to Chicago almost 20 years ago, when we saw restorative justice as radical, as you know, as a needed intervention, and then we saw the state come along, and those were demands of communities, of grandmas, of teachers, of parents, of young folks. The demand was really to think about restorative practices, restorative systems, restorative justice, and then the state, you know, after denying that and, you know, saying that would never work and challenging us and fighting us every step of the way, you know, now Chicago Police now does restorative justice work, right? So I think we want to be very careful and engage in sort of continuous and critical movement assessment to keep and keep our eyes on the prize.
A little bit of a blip, but we're back.
Yes, technical blip. I was out of stress.
But we're back now. We're back. We're doing the thing.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, I didn't say it initially, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I'm so honored to have you on the show.
I really value this conversation. I mean, these are the kinds of conversations that we were hoping that the book would create. I do think that what's exciting to me about this moment is that many people are really talking about what makes our community strong and safer. And sometimes they're using 25-cent language. I don't know if I'd put the word abolition in that 25-cent language category, but maybe I'd put words like, you know, patriarchy or the prison industrial complex in that category of jargon. But I'm heartened, I'm moved, I'm excited about the fact that so many people are like, yeah, what does make my community stronger and safer? I mean, I've done different campaigns around jail expansion or pushing back on the construction of new immigration prisons. I think it's important that we call them prisons and not detention centers mm-hmm. or facilities. Mm-hmm. Right? And, you know, door knocking and talking to people, asking people what makes your neighborhood safer, what makes you feel stronger. Sometimes the instinctive response is like, you know, cops. But once you kind of start talking to people, they're like, yeah, there's my kid's school closed in the neighborhood. There's no jobs. There's no place. Mm-hmm. The park that I want my kid to go play at doesn't have any equipment, doesn't have anything. there's no organized kind of sports, or, you know, my kid has nowhere to go after school or has to take two buses to go to school because they closed the local public school. You know, I mean, people are not always right. But I think people, the people closest to the problem, that old adage, have sometimes the best ways to respond to the solution. So if you stay with it, like these conversations around safety, like, yeah, I could use, I need a job that makes a flourishing wage, right? You know, I need healthcare, right? You know, I need a school that is not tracking my young person to go to the penitentiary down the block, or to a future of employment that is dehumanizing, right? Yeah, I feel like these conversations about defunding the police and investing in communities, you know, are actually really real and grounded, and they resonate with people across the country right now, because we're tired, right? And we are seeing the resources being drained towards more surveillance cameras in neighborhoods, you know, SWAT teams for our police forces so they can execute no-knock warrants, and, you know, I mean, and we're like, that's not the kind of safety that is in my heart, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you don't have much time, and I definitely wanted to get to this question, because this is the question du jour when we talk about any sort of reform or abolition. Michelle Alexander wrote what I think is a good book, The New Jim Crow. And in that, she uses the term prison industrial complex, and definitely it talks a lot about nonviolent offenders. And I think that's why people really latched onto that and the 13th documentary that kind of accompanied it. In the abolition world, and especially in this book, you are taking on the question of what about the murderers and the rapists? Because that's constantly the question when we talk about prison abolition. I'm sure when you guys do press for this book, that's the first thing people ask you. Well, what about the murderers and the rapists? What are we going to do about that?
Yeah. I mean, I like answering that question because it's a really helpful question. And it's also a real question that people have that is about safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing that I would, that I reply with is, you know, it's not that our police and our systems of prisons and sentencing and prosecution, you know, is actually ending gender and sexual violence or ending forms of interpersonal violence, right? So just reminding people about that gently or forcefully, because I think the fear of safety is real, but just reminding people that it's not like the current framework we got is getting us towards safety. So I think that's one starting place. Then I think another response that is important to push is this distinction between violent and nonviolent offenders. You know, even that state language offenders, I think what one of the gifts of social movements, gifts of restorative and transformative and abolitionist movements, is just to ask us to step back a little bit and always pay attention to the way that a problem gets framed or the language that the state is using. So this, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about, you know, the nonviolent offenders and the violent offenders in this political moment around the criminal legal system. And I also like to use the term criminal legal system instead of criminal justice system, because there's not much justice happening in our criminal legal system now. like in my state, you know, there's so many people that I think it's half the people in my state, Illinois, have convictions for what gets called a violent offense. And then they're iced out, they're axed out of any kind of, you know, potential reform or response that might allow them the opportunity to be accountable for the harm that they've done, to transform, right, to rejoin communities and rejoin families, to repair, to be part of a solution. So I really want to push us a little bit to not fall for the way that the state is creating these divisions between so-called nonviolent, you know, crimes and violent crimes. Because, you know, I think that that not that the language of crime itself we want to kind of back up from as well. Not all harm, you know, is criminalized, right? And not all that we see as a crime is actually harmful, right? So I think we need to kind of back away, right? So that's, you know, that's a little bit of a meta there, kind of in terms of points to be thinking about. But I like to answer that question because it grounds us in an ability to build solutions. Like if we are actually interested in the rapists and the murderers, what actually would hold them accountable? What actually would stop them from doing that harm in the first place, right? What actually would meet the needs of the people who have experienced the harm, right? And once we start surfacing and putting those questions to the front, which is something that restorative and transformative and abolitionist movements continue to do, right? What is the person who needs the harm, experience the harm? What do they need? How do we hold the person who's done the harm accountable? How do we transform the conditions that made that harm possible? Then really what falls away, the criminal legal system kind of falls away because it's not addressing any of those questions. It's not offering responses for people who've experienced harm, right? It's not offering ways to hold the person accountable who's done that harm, right? And to get them to repair the harm that they've done, right? And also to transform the conditions that made that harm possible in the first place. So I think that, you know, that answering that question, what about the bad people, really offers us an opportunity to shine a spotlight on the system, on the system that's working precisely as it's designed to work, but is not actually addressing any of those core questions about safety, about accountability, about transformation that we really need to be addressing.
Do you feel that, I mean, I think one thing that we are talking about is the police, for the most part, are policing poverty and creating a lot of it.
Yeah.
In the long run. I had Alex Vitale, who wrote the book, The End of Policing, on the show a few weeks ago.
Great.
And we definitely,
good book.
We have that. Yeah. Love the book. Decent dude. And we definitely had that discussion. And I see it on a daily basis. The policing of poverty.
Yeah.
I think when we say things like abolish the carceral state, people are so used to putting poor people away, mm-hmm. be it for violent crime or just for being poor, debtor's prisons. How do we get out of that mindset? What's the first step to take to try to get out of that mindset of really pulling back and seeing the whole picture?
Yeah. I'm really appreciative of that book and all the affiliated work that kind of has led up to this moment. I know I keep saying that on this call, but I'm just really feeling a need to lift up that it's been collectives and organizing that has brought us to this political moment, because I think it helps us also think about the work going forward as a long haul mm-hmm. work, right? Mm-hmm. It also reminds me of a book title of a valued comrade, Angela Davis, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, right? And yes. One of the fears I have in this political moment is that, you know, people are going to see, you know, especially people who are maybe newer to the struggle or are kind of just coming into the work, right? Which, welcome. Mm-hmm. There's a seat for you at the table. We are so excited you're here. But this is long haul work. This is long haul paradigm change work, not a checklist, right? You know, we're not going to make the kind of societal, political, economic, cultural changes through just some little tweaks, some little tiny reformations. You know, we're in it for the long haul, and we're thinking about paradigm changes. And I think that your example of the criminalization of poverty is sort of one thread that, you know, is important to unravel, and because it illuminates, you know, so many ways in which we've turned to policing to mask, you know, systemic problems, right? That whether it's, you know, the lack of a free and affirming mental health care system as well, right? Mm-hmm. As you referenced earlier in this call, like when we don't have those services available for people, and Chicago shut, you know, I think it's 4 public mental health care centers in the city of Chicago, but yet we can build a $95 million police academy on the southwest side of Chicago, but we don't have the money for mental health care, right? I think that we need to be thinking about the specific campaigns, the specific work, the specific projects, but also be thinking about a wider analysis, a wider vision, and a longer struggle, right? So, like, I'm heartened by the defund the police movement right now and all the organizing, but yet, you know, I work at a prison for people the state considers men, 45 minutes from Chicago, where people are, you know, experiencing death by incarceration or serving life sentences, many of them for harms that they committed in their early 20s. And many of them, it's also an epicenter of COVID, you know, in this political moment. And we haven't gotten anybody out. Nobody's getting out of prison, right? Despite in San Quentin, same situation in the Bay Area. Yeah.
We had some people let out in a county, I think the county jail let some people out, actually.
Yeah. So how do we make these connections, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're working to challenge the criminalization of poverty, which is important, right? Mm-hmm. But we also, I think one of the traps we can fall into there is the argument that these are the innocent people, right? That poor people are criminalized because they're poor, but they're really innocent, right? You know, so we don't want to get stuck in, you know, of course we want to decriminalize the ways in which the state has criminalized poverty or mental health issues, right? All of that is central and important, right? But we don't want to end up in a situation where we're just focusing kind of our earlier discussion about on the you know, the people who are innocent, the people who are kind of proxies for innocence, young people, you know, women that are pregnant, you know, people with mental health challenges, right? People who are poor. We need to see every campaign as connected to unraveling, you know, the wider systems.
Oh, thank you for that answer.
No problem. No problem. I mean, I think that's the, you know, that's the challenge, right? And I also just, you know, want to remind us that there's no campaign that also isn't about, like, defunding the police, but it's no use defunding the police if we're also not challenging white supremacy and heteropatriarchy and capitalism. So it's always got to be the both and. But I think we are beautiful. We are amazing. We can do the both and. We have always been able to hold on to multiple, you know, campaigns and projects and visions at the same time. And I think it's imperative that we're in this moment kind of doing that work on multiple ranges or registers or levels. And I mean, art, social movements do that really well. I think that, you know, I always think about the ACT UP movement and, or in this political moment, I've been thinking about that, the campaign of ACT UP to raise the visibility of the government's, you know, grotesque negligence of people living with HIV and how that was direct action, that was creating a new cultural visible language through visual arts, right? That was people most impacted stepping up and making decisions. That was organizing, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, the government, people forget that the government ignored HIV, and Reagan said, if anybody remembers that, oh, we'll have a vaccine for this in a few months.
Oh my God, I know. It's just echoes of this moment.
Yeah. And the age of COVID, I mean, you guys wrote this book, of course, before knowing that a deadly pandemic was going to hit the country and really change so much. How has, in your opinion, COVID changed all this? Because like you said, with the prisons, I actually have a friend that works in San Quentin, and just, he sounded frightened.
Yeah.
He sounded very frightened. He was like, everybody's going to get it. And he just hung up the phone.
Yeah.
And he just, we've let some people out. I can't remember which facility it was. They let a few hundred people out, but they literally just let them out. It's not like they had somewhere to go. Which is another problem, right? How do you think COVID exacerbates all this?
I mean, the first thing I think about is sort of the austerity logic that has come along with the COVID, you know, sort of the economic reconfiguration has, like, you know, so many people I know have lost jobs or are laid off or are already marginally, you know, economically positioned in the so-called gig just-in-time economy, right? So I think that has pushed, you know, the state to offer these, you know, intense bailout packages for United Airlines and, you know, I don't know, Deloitte and Touche or whatever those companies are called. And I think it has sort of provided an anxiety and a feeling that it has given legs to this sort of austerity logic that we don't have enough, that we have to bail out certain entities and not others. But you know, we have money to bail out United Airlines, but we don't have money for healthcare. We don't have money to bail out, you know, public school systems, right? So I think that COVID has really, is providing the perfect opportunity for the state to reconfigure. I mean, crisis is always an opportunity for those in power to double down on the existing power lines, to double down on existing oppressive structures. And it's also the opportunity to see that doubling down and resist and, you know, and crack it. So I think that we're, you know, that's the first thing I sort of think about in relation to this moment is this sort of crisis opportunity, but also risk. And my worry that we are falling into this austerity logic and the, you know, and the same old stories, the same old narratives are being reproduced. And, you know, I think that's sort of, we see that with this sort of like turn to law and order. Like we need the police to, you know, be social workers. You know, kind of help and manage, you know, we need to kind of tamp down on the situation. And I also think, you know, we need the expansion of surveillance as a way to promote public health, right? So I feel like, you know, crisis opportunity in this moment, in this COVID moment. And of course, I'm not even mentioning the, you know, massive disproportionate toll on, you know, who's most, you know, vulnerable, who has lost their lives in this moment, you know, people with the, you know, pre-existing conditions that had already been, you know, essentially abandoned by the state in terms of healthcare and support. So disproportionately poor folks, disproportionately people of color, of course. Right. So just trying to, you know, flag a little bit of the COVID moment. And I'm hopeful that the insurgent, you know, mobilizations around defunding the police can create openings and political opportunities to talk about kind of a rejecting an austerity politics, talking about, you know, what's happening inside our prisons and jails right now, or really kind of thinking about extending abolition, you know, to other places that we might see as sort of unlikely, right? Or places that we might see as less directly connected to the prison industrial complex, like child and family services, you know, which polices, in particular, Black caregivers, right? Or public schools. I'm excited that it's those conversations are happening there, but also in our families and our neighborhoods. So I'm hopeful that, you know, I'm hopeful that this moment of insurgency, this moment of COVID can create opportunities for different kinds of political education as well.
Well, in Oakland, we just passed a measure to get the police out of the public schools.
Yes, I know. Black Organizing Project. Jackie, that's 10 years of work, right? 10 years of work. You know, so again, that's my sort of like, I think we want to recognize these wins, but we also want to flag that in schools, it's not just, you know, cops that police, you know, so this camp, this sort of chant of like counselors, not cops, Yes, but, right, we also know that social workers, I think it's like 75% of people who earn a master's of social work degree in the United States are white ladies, right? And, you know, that field can be, is, you know, routinely weaponized against Black caregivers, right? And Indigenous caregivers, mm-hmm. right? So I think we want to be, you know, freedom is a constant struggle. Yes, we got cops out of schools, but it's also important to be challenging all the underlying belief systems that are able, you know, when white people are calling the cops on Black folks that are barbecuing, that are bird watching, you know, that are, you know, trying to open their front door. I mean, we also need to be doing the equally important work, right, of, you know, dismantling those belief systems. And, you know, this is sort of, you know, thinking about all of these pieces together. And sometimes people are like, that's overwhelming. There's just so many places, you know, that we need work we need to be doing. I actually think it's like, great, there's work for everybody, right? You know, there's places for everybody. there's no, people are often like, I don't know how to get started, or like, there's so much going on. It's like, great, there's like lots of places to work then.
My fear is that in this moment, there's so many people that get excited about instant change. So when, you know, I want to defund the police. And in Minnesota, the city council was like, well, we're going to defund the police. And it was just kind of said, and there was no plan. It was just said, and, you know, the high-fiving starts and all that other stuff. That's my fear, that sometimes you get a lot of empty rhetoric from your politicians after this, and the people that were on the outside of these movements start high-fiving themselves and just walk away. That's my fear.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I do think that's why we, you know, we got to be organized. We got to see ourselves in it for the long haul. We got to, you know, always be anticipating how the state is going to co-opt the work or absorb the work or co-opt our people or our language or our demands and use those against us, right? And I know the way that I'm, you know, sketching this sounds a little like dreary and maybe like, I don't know, like the work is all painstaking. And I think there are incredible costs. There are significant personal costs to people. You know, I think of the amazing CeCe McDonald and her campaign, you know, in 2012 in Minneapolis, you know, she survived an incredible form of street violence, racist and transphobic street violence, but, you know, was able to organize and push back and demand. So I just offer that just to remind us there are incredible costs in doing this work. But mm-hmm. I also want to say that it can be joyous, right? And that it can be affirming. And, you know, I always say it's like a way to find, you know, to find the people for the long haul. So I just want to, you know, recognize that there are challenges in doing this work and there are incredible costs, but also that, it can also be both affirming and joyous. And, you know, these are the people, we are the people we've been waiting for, to quote somebody smarter than I am.
this is a long haul. This is not, like you said, it's not a checklist. The person that I'm speaking with, Erica R. Miners, co-author of The Feminist and the Sex Offender, Confronting Sexual Harm, Ending State Violence. You can pick it up on Verso Books. There will definitely be a buy link in the description for this. Thank you again for taking the time to talk to me. I know you're very busy. I'm going to play some music right now. Please don't hang up.
It was totally a joy. I appreciate the conversation and the work. And onward.